a lecture series on operational general relativity based on the paper there. This is lecture one. Lecture zero is was the colloquium I gave last week. So I wouldn't be giving this lecture course if I hadn't been hassled over a prolonged period of time by two people. One is Ravi, who hasn't turned up yet, but no doubt he's coming. And the other is my wife, Zivi. So that combined forces eventually persuaded me to do this. So this is a lecture series, and it occurred to me that there's a subtle difference between a lecture series and a lecture course. So a lecture series can be recent research. It could be wrong. It's intended for colleagues, you know, other researchers, as well as students. A famous example of a lecture series would be Andrew Wiles giving his lecture series in Cambridge, which started off as a lecture series on some obscure topics in mathematics. Initially a lot of people attended because it was Andrew Wiles, but then numbers started to fall off. And then towards the end, people started to suspect that he was going to announce a solution to Fermat's Last Theorem. And then the media got interested, and apparently there were TV cameras in the final lecture. There won't be any surprises like that in this lecture series. Unless I get lucky over the course of the next term. So some people may be taking this as a course. Jamie emailed me to say that this could be also a course. So if you belong to that category, please email me so I know who you are. And I could maybe organize some extra tutorial sessions. Okay. So there's lots of people doing sort of related work, and I mentioned a lot of that in my colloquium last week. Two things I omitted to mention, and they're important, are there's a work by John Barrett from 2005. And this is sort of, he set up the sort of questions that many people investigated in this general probability framework subsequently. And then the other person I forgot to mention was Robert Urkel. He comes really more from the quantum gravity and quantum foundations background, unlike most of the other people I mentioned. He's been pursuing this general boundary formalism for many years. But in recent years, he's moved over to the operational side, and his work is increasingly similar to the other foundational guys I mentioned. And there's a certain convergence between his attitude and my attitude. He doesn't work at this stage on this sort of operational space, on the operational space that I mentioned in the colloquium, but there's many similarities otherwise. And he's working more on quantum field theory than general relativity. So I realize many people here won't have a background in general relativity. Neither did I when I got into this. And so I wrote, in the course of trying to get up to speed, I wrote a short introduction to standard GR, which is Appendix A in the long paper. And that may be useful for people trying to get to grips with the basics. Of course, there are also many great books and courses, including a number of courses on PERSA that you can look at. Okay, one more note. In the paper, I make a lot of use of different fonts. And that becomes a problem if you're giving a Blackboard lecture, because it's very difficult to give accurate renditions of different fonts. Like, I think I can do this versus this for different A's, but try doing that for B or C, and it gets increasingly difficult. So I haven't quite solved that problem yet. Fortunately for today's lecture, it won't matter too much. I may use different colored chalk, or I don't know. Anyway, that's a problem to look out for in subsequent lectures. Okay, So this is lecture one. And today I'm going to talk about operational and ontological elements. In a sense, what I'm trying to do today is, you know, if you read for a sort of a textbook on quantum theory and slowly but surely they set up the sort of framework for states and density matrices and the trace operation and that kind of thing. Well, I want to do something which is a similar to that for this operational version of GR. Today it will just be the basics. Next week it will be some further operational and ontological elements. So let's just summarize. Well, actually, one of the things I want to get to at the end is I want to, this lecture is, I'm hoping I'll get to the point where I can tell you the difference, so far as the physics is concerned, between that object, a set whose only element is the empty set, and this object, just the empty set. Okay. Let's see if I get there. So let me just summarize a few of the points from lecture zero. So first of all, in general relativity, we have various tensor fields. And I'm going to represent them just by this object. And they consist of the metric g mu nu, plus a whole bunch of matter fields. In general relativity, any field which is not the metric is regarded as a matter field. It's the terminology. So for example, electromagnetic fields belong in this camp. And then what you do in general relativity is you have a set of field equations. This consists of a bunch of matter field equations, and then also Einstein's field equation. The famous field equation that Einstein derived. And you find solutions. And a solution typically looks like this. Oh, actually. Yeah, typically a solution looks like this. What you do is you specify at each point P on a manifold these tensor fields. So that's the sort of way a solution looks. Now, as I said on Wednesday last week, in order to do this, take this operational approach, we need to set up what I call an operational space. So to do that, we define a set of scalar fields, S. And these scalar fields are calculated from these tensor fields at a point. And now we imagine plotting these scalar fields, S1, S2. Okay, since I'm drawing on the blackboard, I can only do three dimensions, but in general, you could have up to k different scalars. And this object, this now gives us our operational space. And the idea is that these scalars capture the kind of things that we directly observe. So things corresponding to any coincidence measurements of fields having certain values, these scalar fields having certain values, are the kind of things we might observe. So that provides us with our operational raw material. And then we're interested in small regions inside operational space, which don't have to be cuboid, but I'm drawing a cube because I can. So small regions in operational space. And we're interested in what we might see in there.
Question?
Yes.
So the electromagnetic field is an example of a field which is not a scalar observable, right? So,
that's right, yeah.
So are we restricting ourselves to certain one scalar observables,
or
are we temporarily encoding?
No, the idea is that our observations don't directly concern all the properties of the metric field, of the tensor fields, but some essential properties. So so we're just extracting some you might think as a coarse graining or some properties that correspond to our actual observations. And the reasons I choose a set of scalar fields is, as I mentioned in the colloquium, these things are invariant under diffeomorphisms. So the property that scalar field one takes a certain value, and at the same point, scalar field two does, and so on, is invariant under diffeomorphisms. It seems like a good candidate for the kind of things we directly observe. And from that, we can infer things about the tensor fields that live behind the scenes. Okay. By the way, I'm very happy to take questions during this series of lectures. Okay. Now what we can do is we can imagine, well, the thing we actually see may be some subset. So this is a region A. What we actually observe will be some subset of the points in here, which I'm going to call gamma A. Okay, so that's a surface inside here. And then we can consider parts of solutions that map into here. So let's take this. And the idea is, so notice this is a subset of the original manifold. So this part of a manifold has the property that the points in here are inside the set A. So in a sense, this is the part of a solution that's relevant to this particular region of operational space. Are there any questions at this stage? I think it's simple, but it's basic, so make sure everyone understands.
Why is it a surface, or rather than like maybe a subset of the square of the?
Yeah, it could be all sorts of different things. What we do know is that as long as everything is appropriately smooth, the dimension of this will not be greater than the dimension of the manifold. But it may have dimension that's less than the manifold. It may have places where it's the same dimension as the manifold and other places where it shrinks down to a smaller dimension. So yeah, this could actually be quite a complicated surface. But I'm just trying to draw something. So that's my. And it may even not touch the boundary of this region. Okay. Yeah.
Is this MA going to be a submanifold of M if A?
Sorry, which A? Sorry, this A?
MA.
MA, yeah. It's a subset of the points in some larger manifold.
Okay, but if A is somehow like nice in some way.
So what? Okay, so.
It would be like differential manifold as well.
So it would be. So it may be something like a manifold with corners. I'll talk about this a little bit later. So a manifold with corners is one that's sort of like a manifold, except that in some places you cover it, you have boundaries. The hope is that as long as this region is defined in a well-defined way, then this will also be relatively well-defined. It could have disjoint parts. There's no reason why that wouldn't happen. There could be disjoint parts of this of a solution that satisfy this mapping. So you could have, so it could consist of disjoint parts. Without any particular proof, I'm going to assume it's sufficiently well behaved to do all the things I want to do. But there's certainly room for better proofs there. Okay. Okay, now I'm realizing I've used the blackboards in the wrong way. I think what I'll do is I'll send that up. I'll bring that down. Okay, so one thing you can do to something like that is you can act on it with a diffeomorphism. So diffeomorphism is basically a smooth one-to-one map. I'm not going to go into great details on these things, but you'll find details in the paper or any book, any good book. On GR. So this is a diffeomorphism that takes the point P to the point Q. So it's mapping all the points on the manifold to different points. And one thing you can do is you can act on a solution or a part of a solution like this with a diffeomorphism. Okay. So I'm acting on this solution with a diffeomorphism. Well, what I get is P goes to Q. Under this diffeomorphism, the tensor fields get transformed. And the details of how that happens aren't especially important, other than the fact that it does. But you can find details in the paper. But that's normally written like this. And then also the manifold patch, or this part of the manifold, also gets transformed, moved somewhere else. Okay. Q is just a dummy variable, so you can write that as P. And now the crucial thing in general relativity is that this object is physically equivalent, has exactly the same physical meaning as the one we started off with over there. So in general relativity, when you apply a diffeomorphism, when you move your solution over the manifold, you don't change the physics at all. The points are just sort of arbitrary labels that don't have intrinsic meaning. Okay. So in some ways, what that means is that if I write down a solution like this psi tilde up there, it's not presented in a diffeomorphism invariant fashion because, well, here's a different way of writing down the same physics. So one way that turns out to be useful to represent the physics in a diffeomorphism invariant fashion is to is to write it down like this. I simply take the set of all physically equivalent ways of writing the solution. Okay. And notice now I've removed the tilde.
This we define for each psi tilde A.
Say it again, sorry. Define for each.
For each psi tilde A,
yeah.
We define a psi A.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, so you can start with some psi tilde A. Apply all the diffeomorphisms to it, and then you get a psi A. Yeah. Later on, I'll talk about something called mixed solutions, and that's a bit different. But for the moment, these solutions, where you have a set, all of whose elements are physically equivalent, related by diffeomorphism, that's called a pure solution.
And we define psi tilde A for each phi.
You assigned phi tilde A each phi. Which phi are you talking about? Sorry, there's two phis. The Diffie-Mawson phi?
No, the phi.
No, so you imagine there's some fixed set of fields that you're working with. Okay. Fixed set of fields. And then, you know, and all your physics is going to be done with that fixed set of fields, whatever the problem is you're considering. And then, when you form phi tilde 8, it's just with respect to that fixed set of fields. You can consider a different psi tilde A with the same set of fields. Maybe I'm not understanding your question. Try ask the question in a different way.
What if, so phi tilde A is a set? And what are the...
It's a set of pairs of P and then the value of the fields at P. It might help if I wrote that phi is a function of P.
Okay. Phi evaluated at the point P for each P.
That's right, yeah. So think of it as the set of all those pairs. This way of thinking kind of is nicer if you want to then use this notation where you take subparts of the solution and you're just taking a subset. And so it's sort of a different way of thinking about functions.
And phi of P, I'm still continuing that question, is evaluated on a solution to all the equations of motion.
So if you want, so later I'm going to talk about sets of solutions, but if you want, this thing here, so there's two things you can do, I'll talk about later. You can either consider candidate solutions, so those are just objects, they may or may not be solutions, or things that are solutions. If they are solutions, they have to satisfy the field equations of general relativity for the situation you have at all points P. Okay. Yeah.
So I was wondering if, when we talk about measurements, we're seeing it as something totally separated from, like, the process of doing the measurement, totally separated from something going on with the matter field. I know that might be like the question that we are part of the matter fields, like measuring each other.
Right.
Are we thinking of it at least now in a separate way that we get the, you know, the coinciding values of these scalars, kind of in like an outside, from an outside view? And
yeah, so I would, I mean, yeah, there are many ways to think about this. Maybe one way to think about it is this, you know, in this room we've got a certain operational level of description. We've got the chairs and the tables and, you know, things like this. And we want to have something in general relativity that corresponds to that operational level of description. Okay, and this is what I'm proposing that the this operational space is. You could have made a different choice, like I said on Wednesday. You could have chosen some different variables for that. They have to be diffeomorphism invariant. But this seems like a very natural choice because the notion of coincidence is central to general relativity, and this relies on a notion of properties having values in coincidence. Okay.
Say if you have two solutions, or two like completely separate solutions, the phi that you put in that like pair, do you put just one of the solutions, or do you put both?
So the, which phi, the big
phi.
Capital phi? Yeah, both solutions would have the same phi in it. Yeah. You mean separate solutions in different regions of operational space, or just different solutions?
Two separate solutions in the same problem.
Oh, then they would have the same phi. Yeah. Yeah, because in general relativity, if you're finding different solutions to the same physical situation, you're specifying the same set of fields, but just, you know, there are many, there's more than one solution for the same set of fields. So this is the same thing. So there exist multiple solutions in general relativity for some given type of physical situation. Go on.
Just a quick question. When you're defining these scatterfields in the original space, is there any reason to think that there might be a finite number of scatterfields, or is it going to be still
So I think the only reason to make it, the main reason to make it finite is just that this corresponds, it's sort of ontologically contingent, you know, operationally contingent. We when we do experiments, we only have a finite amount of stuff we're going to look at to describe the world in operational terms. You know, when we write an account of our experiment, there's only a finite account of that experiment given. And so in this language, that would correspond to some finite set of scalars. Yeah. You can define infinitely many scalars, in GR. At a certain point, they start to get fairly dependent on each other. But certainly you can find an infinite number.
So just to make sure I've got it straight, is it accurate to say then that the psi tilde is an individual field configuration while the psi without the tilde is like an equivalence class?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, that's right. At this stage, yeah. I'm going to develop this notion of psi without the tilde shortly, but for the moment it's an equivalence class, yeah. Okay. Let's see if I can not be tricked by the blackboards this time. So later on, we're going to consider joining solutions corresponding to adjacent regions or different regions of operational space. So we may have two different regions of operational space. So here's one, B, and here's another. This is really testing my artistic abilities. So two regions, and they meet at a certain place. And then we can imagine that there's some gamma surface in each of these regions, gamma A. And then over here, gamma, got the wrong way around. This is gamma B, this is gamma A. When we look at different psi tildes, we'll have manifolds that end up getting mapped onto these gamma surfaces. Which might look like this. And then they'll join somewhere. And the join is a local thing. We want to have local boundary conditions along this join. Now, it turns out that to make this thing work, and I'll explain why, we need to put MA. Okay. I feel like I've skipped a whole thing here. Yeah, I'm sorry. The questions, although they were good, distracted me. let me go here. So in the colloquium, I gave one reason for using operational space instead of the manifold. And the reason I gave was that the manifold is, in some sense, non-stick, as far as reality is concerned. It's perfectly non-stick. And the reason for that is that you might try to say what's happening in a certain region of the manifold, but then you can hit that with that solution with a diffeomorphism, and then you'll have different fields in that region. And so you can't really talk about what's happening in a region of the manifold. So that's one reason not to do everything in manifold space, but instead to find some different space. The other reason, which I didn't give in the colloquium, is that the manifold is itself one of the things that's varying. It's one of the variables. And so it's good to work in a space where you can consider the manifold varying. So in particular, it could be that if you consider a solution corresponding to a particular region, so a particular gamma A, particular set in operational space, then there could be many different solutions that are consistent with that. So here I'm taking the set of all different psi tildes that map into this gamma A. And so, of course, first of all, you'll have all the diffeomorphisms acting on any of these. So that provides you, each of those diffeomorphisms will give you a different MA. But then in addition to that, it may be that this surface isn't sufficient to capture all the physics. And so you may have physically inequivalent psi tildes that appear in this list. And so those would also come with their own manifolds, and manifolds that wouldn't necessarily be diffeomorphism equivalent to one another. So the manifold itself is one of the variables that one of the things that can take different values for some fixed observation you might have. So one thing that means is it's good to have a space where all these different manifolds can live. And I'm going to define, hopefully today, a space which I call, I'll denote by this, some bigger space in every manifold that you might want to consider. The way the space is going to be constructed, every manifold you might want to consider is a subset of that bigger space. And I'll call this the chartable space. Okay, that's 2B defined. Okay, so back to where I was. We could have two regions of operational space, each with some gamma set defined. And now we may want to, these things will come from, in the different solutions, they'll come from manifolds that get mapped into here. We're going to want to impose local boundary conditions along here and here. And we're going to have that this one here lives in a chartable space WA. And this one here, sorry, getting my A's and B's confused. This one lives in chartable space associated with that. Okay. And then we want to identify the points at the boundary. So there's a lot of details about how we're going to do that. But one point I want to make now is the reason we need separate spaces for these manifolds associated with separate regions of operational space is the following. One thing, if we impose just local boundary conditions, then we cannot stop this kind of thing happening. So here's B. It could be this thing sort of wraps underneath. And intersects MA. And we don't want that to happen because we know the S fields are different here. And so consequently, these manifolds shouldn't be touching. They shouldn't share points in common. But there's no way to stop that happening if we only impose local boundary conditions, if we then vary over all possible manifolds.
What is this construction we're making? Why are we joining MA and MB?
Well, later on, we're going to be interested in taking regions of operational space that are adjacent and then looking at the solutions for those joint regions. And to do that, we want to join solutions for each of the separate regions together. That will entail joining manifold bits of the manifold for each of those two regions. Does that make sense? And when we do that, we want to be sure we don't get this sort of these two bits of the manifold intersecting somewhere else away from the place where we impose boundary conditions. And the way to stop that is to have them living in different spaces. then they can't intersect because they're in different spaces. And you just identify that out of the way. You just identify the points at the boundary. Okay.
Is MA an element of WA or subset?
Oh, sorry, not an, yeah, subset, yeah. Thanks. Well caught. Okay. No, I have a space. I did this on purpose. So let me just give you the definition, or basic definition of a manifold. In simple terms, a manifold is a set of points that is smooth and everywhere looks locally like R to the M. Sort of better way to say that is a set of points is a manifold if it can be covered by open subsets to be a calligraphic O. That's the first condition. The second condition is that you can lay down a coordinate system in each of these open subsets. So a coordinate system, what that means is you have a subset of R to the n, which is where the coordinate system is valid, and you can in this region OI, you can use that coordinate system. So the corresponding diagram is, you know, you have some manifold, and then you can cover it with lots of these open sets. And then in each of these regions, you can use a coordinate system. So X corresponds to a n-tuple of real numbers. Sure. Mapping that. Okay. And then there's one more condition, which is a technical condition. Whose purpose is to guarantee that you have smooth joining where there's OIs intersect, everything is smooth. Where these sets overlap, there's certain technical conditions there, which are not difficult, I don't want to cover them now. Okay. Now, actually, the things we're going to be interested in are really these sort of manifolds that have boundaries. So an example of that would be manifolds with corners. We talked about this earlier, the sort of things that you get if you impose these restrictions on operational space, then you get parts of the manifold. And I'm going to assume those are sufficiently well-behaved. And so that's the real set of objects I'm interested in, is things that have boundaries. in principle. Okay. So now I want to define this thing. I call it chartable space. It turns out to be very useful for the construction I have later. So I'm going to write, well, if you look at, let me just make a point. If you look at this construction here, the definition of the manifold, if you're in, draw that diagram again. You know, if you're at this point, then there's no coordinate given for either of these regions. And likewise, if you're here, then no coordinate for those and so on. So rather than just giving no coordinate, I'm going to express the coordinate as taking the value blank in those cases. So now the coordinates are slightly expanded. A coordinate is now an element of R to the N. A union with this, just this blank element. Okay. So when you specify a coordinate, now you can specify a coordinate for every single region, but if the point isn't in that region, you just specify it by the blank option. And then, in order to cover a manifold, you may need arbitrarily many of these charts. So you could need an infinite number of such charts. So I'm going to represent that by this. I've forgotten the name for this symbol. Okay. So now, for every point on this space, we can give a value for this, because some of the points may just have the blank element. The next thing I want to do is define this. As the set of all possible values of this. Okay. Is everyone with me? All right. Okay. Now, so this is a set of points which have coordinates. Now I want there to be a space W. This is my chartable space in one-to-one correspondence with dollar. So this is a space whose points can be labeled by points in dollar. Okay. So I have a map, an invertible map, F, that takes me from this space to dollar. Okay. If I have a subset of points in here, then that will take me to a subset of the points in dollar.
Sorry, I think I missed. What is a dollar?
Were you okay up to here?
Yep.
So this is an infinite collection of coordinates where you supplement each coordinate with this possible value. And then dollar is the space of all these possible points.
Okay. Is dollar like an atlas?
Is that, sorry?
Is this what people call an atlas? I thought X was a coordinate chart, X.
Yeah, no, so so yes, I want to define a concept called a super atlas, which will provide an atlas of the many different manifolds. And essentially, that's what a dollar is going to do for us. But if you restrict yourself to one manifold, like here, then it's giving you an atlas for that manifold. Okay. But there's many possible M's that are subsets of... Of course, not any subset of W will be a manifold. But there are many possible... Any manifold can be regarded as a subset of W. The reason for that is because you can just take... I kind of said it already. So you can take... if you take your charts, then you can just plot the xi is that x is equal to this in the definition of a manifold for the points that are in here. Otherwise, say again, sorry?
Because otherwise we cannot
have what?
Tell R to N coordinates for the whole space.
I'm not assuming it's topologically suitable.
It's not saying that it's a covered
form. Yeah. The point is that, take any manifold, you'll have these kinds of, you'll have an atlas for that manifold consisting of these sorts of functions. But the points on the manifold get mapped to these charts, and you have a collection of those charts. The only thing we're doing extra is, in the case where the point isn't in the associated region, we're giving it a value, call it blank, just so we can notate it, really. And then we can have this section of values. And I'm sure this construction exists somewhere. It seems too natural to be new, but I had to find a construction like this so I could refer to the space, a space in which these manifolds live. So this function, I call it a super atlas because it provides a way of giving coordinates to all the different manifolds that would be subsets of this. So F is a super atlas. And then for my construction, I want to stick with a given super atlas, okay, all the way through. So I'm going to stick with a given one, which I'll call F. So F is going to, I'm going to call that the fiducial super atlas. One interesting point is that if you have this manifold, I think that's a manifold. Anyway, if you have this object, then the associated associated set of dollar is just this. You have all blanks. Okay. Right.
Let's put this up.
So it's good that W also includes the empty set as a possible object, because the empty set will frequently crop up. in this approach. Okay. So we now have diffeomorphisms. So diffeomorphism now is acting in W. And this is a smooth one-to-one map. So there's some technical things that I haven't proven here, and somebody might want to have a go at that. I'm assuming these things exist, so that suddenly, if you take a diffeomorphism just acting on a manifold, so you can define smooth maps like this, which are invertible, satisfy the differentiability requirements for diffeomorphisms. And I'm going to assume that actually we can define diffeomorphisms on the whole of this W space that have the property that whenever they act on a set of points that constitutes a manifold, they are diffeomorphisms in the usual sense of the word. So one thing to note here is that the M prime may be a different collection of points from M, because here we're, even if this is a complete manifold, a full, we're mapping inside W space. So there's lots of room there in W space. So so M can be mapped around to many different places.
So in the definition of psi A, when you define it for all diffeomorphisms, imagine varying all possible.
Exactly, yeah. What am I going to erase this?
After it's on.
Yeah, anyway, yeah, that's right, yeah. So you would want to do that for all of all different options. Yeah. So this is a very big object in some sense. You would never actually do a calculation this way, it would take too long. But these sort of objects are a useful kind of bookkeeping device. And later on, I want to bootstrap everything up into operational terms. But for the time being, we need to have these objects. OK.
I think I missed a bit about the fiducial thing about the fiducial super.
So I said there was a map from W, a one-to-one map from W to dollar.
Yes.
Okay. And of course, there are many possible maps you can imagine between these two. But I'm going to choose a particular one and call that the fiducial one. And since this is a map that gives you an atlas for any manifold, if you look at manifolds, an atlas is just a collection of charts. I'm going to call it a fiducial super atlas.
There's nothing special about it per se, fixing it.
Fix one here. I mean, one property it should have is that, what it kind of has to have is that it takes the fully blank element associated with the empty manifold. Because there's a point that's kind of separated from the rest of W, and it has to take that up to the corresponding point here. But other than that, there's nothing special. And it should be differentiable in some way. OK. So I want to define a notion now of restriction. This is similar to the trace operation in quantum theory. It's kind of the complement to the trace operation. So 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 consider having a subset D of some region A in operational space. We can write down a solution for region A. Like this. And now I want to consider restricting this solution to region B. So what's the part of this solution for region A that corresponds to region B? Okay. So I'm going to define this as the set of points in MA that map into this smaller region B. We've got some the region A, the smaller region B. So these are regions in operational space, but they correspond in a solution to regions of the manifold. And this is the collection of all points that map into this smaller region. And this is an element. This is a subset of the chartable space. Now remember, I said I'm going to associate different chartable spaces with each region of operational space so that I can stop this difficult overlapping issue. So in order to map this, I now need to find a region of space. So I now need to find a part of the manifold. Associate a different chartable space with region B, and then I need to map this into region B. So I need a map from region A to region B.
So the difference between M sub B given A and M sub B would be the chargeable space?
Yes, exactly, yeah, yeah. Exactly that. Yeah. So this is the problem I have. So now I've got to define a way of mapping between chartable spaces. So I'm going to introduce what I call the fiducial identity map. So it maps from A to B. I'll notate it like this. And we'll choose the map so that the elements under this map have the same numerical values in dollar space as the original one. Okay. Does that make sense? So we have this fiducial super atlas, and under this fiducial super atlas, we want this fiducial identity map to map like numerical values. Okay. Is that clear? Any questions? Is it clear, or is it just no one who has a question to ask? Okay, I suspect.
Last statement, like, mathematically.
Okay, so mathematically. Say again, sir?
I'm wondering if there's like some kind of commuting diagram you could do.
I'll think about a commuting diagram, but let me try for a mathematical statement. Yeah, probably a commuting diagram is the right way, isn't it? That's what you had in mind, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes.
Perfect, great. So we define a map, an identity map from here to here. It's invertible. And if you look up here under this fiducial superatlas, which you should really give this index like that, then you get a certain dollar in here. Now you can just take any point in here and find a point in here that has the same numerical values. And then we could define, I suppose, the inverse of this map to get down to WB.
These spaces are not the same, are they?
Which side, sir?
The dimensions of the dollar A and dollar B.
Oh, they're the same. Oh, dollar A and dollar B are they're infinite dimensional spaces, but they consist of a whole. The points are, I've lost it now, but the points in each space are these. Given by these things. So they're the same dimension in some sense. They're infinite dimension. Maybe in the case where there was just one coordinate, okay, just to keep it simple for the moment. So then all I would be saying is this is a map that gives you the same coordinate over here. So this is I see it's after 3 o'clock. So I think the best thing is if I leave I'll continue what I was doing here next week. And if I can explain this, perhaps anyone still is any of these points are still unclear, I'm happy to talk afterwards here at the blackboard. We'll stop just there. Thanks.